Welcome everybody to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thank you for joining us here on the live call. If you're listening on the podcast to Productivity Book Group, today on this call, we will be discussing Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning by Peter C. Brown, Henry L. Roediger III, and Mark A. McDaniel. I'm just going to read the Amazon description because I think it's really helpful for us to get sort of a lead-in on sort of what the book's all about. But the Amazon description describes the book as, drawing on cognitive psychology and other fields, Make It Stick offers techniques for becoming more productive learners and cautions against study habits and practice routines that turn out to be counterproductive. The book speaks to students, teachers, trainers, athletes, and all those interested in lifelong learning and self-improvement. And I think the book does a pretty good job of making good on that commitment. So let's just start off with folks' general thoughts about the book, your experiences that you, as you were reading it, and then we'll go in and sort of talk about some of the big ticket points behind the book and the structure of the book in general. So what was your initial reactions to the book, the way it was written, the way it was structured, and just generally about the premise of it altogether?
Okay. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the book and was very surprised I didn't already know about it. I mean, my background is in education. I was a principal. I was a central office administrator in charge of curriculum. But this one had never been on my radar, and it is so insightful.
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. Yeah, and I'm actually not sure why more people don't know about it.
Wonderful book.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
I'm so glad that you chose it. I hadn't heard of it either, and it's a really wonderful book.
Oh, good. Glad to hear. So
I saw the title and actually thought it was going to be Made to Stick, you know, the popular business book. So even the title did not register.
That's so funny. Yeah, no, I read the book when it came out, and now in this rereading of the book, I just enjoyed it just as much. And I'm not even sure how I stumbled upon it. It must have been a recommendation from somebody somewhere along the way, and I apologize for not being able to give credit to that person. But it made it to my list, and it stuck. And so, but it's a fascinating, read, and it helps sort of overcome a lot of these things that I've said for years are, you know, poor learning techniques. You know, like the big ticket one that the book talks about that I've been just, you know, harping on for years is that people are always like, oh, I need to learn in my particular way of learning. You know, I'm an auditory listener, or I'm a visual, or I'm a kinesthetic learner, and I have to, you know, I have to be able to do it with my hands before I can learn something. And I just really appreciated the book legitimizing my constant, you know, sort of soapbox about that. Yes, yes, it satisfied my needs just for that purpose. And so the book leads off with these misunderstood concepts about learning. Who wants to talk about the sort of some of the things that sort of stood out for you regarding the premise of the book, you know, sort of how they open us up to these misunderstandings about learning and what they plan to sort of educate people about as it relates to not learning well and therefore techniques for learning well?
I'll answer that and also relate it to saying more about my overall thoughts on the book, which is immediately when I started reading even that first chapter, the first two chapters, it sort of became, it gave me some heightened awareness of just like a, I read a fair amount of books, but there's just a very few that rise above them that evoke so much thought to your own self and the things that happen around you. I'm thinking of Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman or Getting Things Done, The Art of Stress-Free Productivity. I immediately started having so many thoughts about myself and how I think and how other people around me operate and started thinking, well, if this is a book about learning and remembering, I'm going to read this carefully and try to learn it and remember it as I go along, and immediately started taking tips that it said just to learn what I was reading in the book, making it sort of self-reflective. That's my overall thought. I guess I'm still not saying the question you just asked about.
No, that's fine. That's fantastic. I mean, it's great to hear the experience.
And to me, it was the idea of working smart versus working hard. the student that reads the textbook and rereads the textbook and rereads the rereads, and then they make a D on the test and they wonder why. And of course, this book really addressed this so beautifully that you really have to interact with the material. Underlining and rereading is not good. Making flashcards and quizzing yourself is very good. So a fun activity, a fairly easy activity to do, an enjoyable activity to put the flashcards together and so forth, but it turns out to be something that's very good for you.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things in this book that just are... Oh, go ahead, Bonnie.
Also, the students and what's been in the news lately, I'm not in education, but there's a student testing government thing that's going on that's controversial right now that it's about standardized testing. Frank, what's the name of that program I'm thinking?
Well, I mean, gosh, there's so much. Are you thinking Common Core?
Common Core. People are arguing about Common Core, and one of the controversial parts is testing, but as I was reading how important it is that testing is to retrieval and to learning, I was thinking, I think people are only arguing about the standardized part, not maybe sometimes the testing is actually helping the students learn the material. I'm not making a stance on Common Core. I just thought maybe there's more to it than what I've heard on the
news. Well, yeah. And of course, even before Common Core, there's been such a debate on standardized testing as a whole, how that one test in the spring determines the reputation of the school, perhaps the principal's job, and that the entire year's focus become doing well on that test, and whatever is being tested becomes the important part of the curriculum, and whatever's not on the test, well, forget it. So we tend to test reading and math, therefore poor old social studies, forget it, you know. So we wonder why kids can't find Mexico on the map. And, of course, the arts aren't on the test, so the arts get pushed out of the curriculum. So, that's been a debate for a long time with standardized testing. Sort of one of the aha
shows
for me.
Television show, The Wire on HBO, Season 3, Education.
Yeah. I think one of the big ahas for me, though, as I went along, was as it talked about maybe testing yourself or trying to answer questions on material that you haven't even read yet. In other words, say before you read the chapter, if you're presented with some question, then it's not a bad thing to try your hand at answering those questions and thinking through them. That then when you read the material, things stick a lot better. And to me, one of the ways that has become so relevant is gamification in education now is a big thing. Software that's asking questions sort of at the level that you are. And so you answer the question right, you answer the question wrong, you earn points. But there are those that would say, well, it looks like you're just testing and testing and testing. Shouldn't you stop and teach? This book would seem to say that the asking of those questions is going to make the student go back to the book and review more and try to figure out where they did well, where they didn't do well, as well or better than, a teacher stepping in to target specific lessons at them. So I guess the big thing there was that that interspersed a bad thing at all.
It was sort of fascinating how to think of testing and quizzing and pop quizzing. And in some of those class tests, they were doing a sort of a reflection thing at the end of every period. Sit down for 3 minutes and write down some things you learned today or think about what we just talked about in our social studies class. How important that is for long-term learning, just the fact of retrieving it from your memory instead of rereading something or looking at the notes that you already wrote.
Something that I've always done is, before I read any, textbook or any other book and that kind of thing, I always try to, identify the questions that I have about the subject, and I never recognize that as being something of great value to others. It's just something that I always did because I've probably said this on other calls, which is that I always think of reading as a conversation with the author, So there's a little bit of, you know, sort of suspension of disbelief, I suppose, Miltonian suspension of disbelief, of me sort of like stepping into a conversation with the author. And so as the author is sort of proffering, I am consistently asking questions, and that turns out that's actually very helpful in what, you know, from the science side of sort of answering why it is that I feel, at least I feel like I digest, you know, sort of ingest and comprehend things much faster and retain them well. And I think that's because of my, you know, innate abilities. It's probably some little innate ability, but also my habit of doing that, you know, just as a standard practice. You know, something else that sort of, and on the topic of testing, you know, I think that it's a tough subject, because for most of us, and I'm not talking about the politics of Common Core, I just mean generally in testing, is knowing the right things to test as you're, you know, in an environment, right? So, like, my big question coming out of the book generally is from sort of a pedagogical versus andragogical approach, right? How do you teach children versus how do you teach adults? And the approach is very different. And the book doesn't necessarily address that, because it sort of, you know, combines the two of them in its research and sort of its and the way in which it posits that you should learn. But the really, you know, interesting thing that I sort of come away with as we discuss it is sort of, you know, how do we take all of these techniques and then sort of bifurcate the two, so that, you know, if I go to a workshop in a conference setting, you know, how much of my approach from a self-testing perspective or from a testing perspective should be done for me to be able to learn and walk away with the material to be able to utilize in my professional or personal capacity, versus children who need to be taught a set of skills to then be able to utilize in further academic studies as well as potentially in their careers. And so I'm curious about folks' thoughts on the approach of, you know, sort of what material might be utilized from the book in, you know, childhood and student learning, and that which should be done in adult sort of education programs. Any thoughts there?
Yeah. Well, I've never really given a lot of thought to that. I mean, you know, my experience has always been that whether it's children or adults, the same principles apply. You're having the background knowledge, and for adults, we sort of have the advantage there because of living longer, we have more background to draw from. But the new learning, that it's just, it has to be tied to things that you already know, concepts that you already have under your belt, in order to be internalized. So I don't know that I've really ever made a big distinction between the two.
Well, so, you know, I look at this from the perspective that I teach adults, you know, all day long. And I know that my approach is very, very different than if I were to walk into a room and attempt to teach, you know, fourth graders, and I would probably not be the best fourth grade teacher. I'm just gonna lay that out there, you know. And I think I'm very good with kids, but I just feel like, you know, my teaching style and therefore the way in which I approach curriculum for them, you know, in a business setting, a professional setting, is just so very different. And maybe the science actually isn't necessarily different, but potentially the approach that you take with regard to how you address them. So, like you said, Frank, I think that it's really important for me to be aware of the knowledge set of the people to whom I'm presenting. You know, so I always want to know sort of their background and their expertise, because then those are the connections that I can make for them when we start workshops. So, you know, so now I'm thinking, what will inform me is that when I go into a meeting or anything else like that, I'm going to be more aware of the questions I ask out the gate for the issues that are on the agenda. So that if we're going to be brainstorming or attempting to solve some kind of problem or discussing an issue, priming people is actually going to be much more useful if I know the context of what they know already and then sort of linking it to that. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, I think that this, you know, the science that we're learning sort of in Make It Stick is actually much more broadly applicable in the professional world as well as in an academic setting. And that's sort of was probably my tangential point along the way there. But bringing, Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me there's a technique used, especially in elementary school, called the KWL chart. Three columns. What do we know? What do we want to know? And what have we learned? That's very successful as teachers approach new learning with students, start a new unit or something, that to just, you know, brainstorm what do we already know about this particular subject. And then secondly, what do we want to know? What are the questions that we have? What is it that we're going to try to unfold as we explore this? And then on the back end, now that we've finished, what is it that we've really learned? What are the big takeaways? And that simple very simple technique is something that is widely used with better teachers and has been extremely successful. Is the KWL chart.
Nah. On one to put in my office. That sounds like a really great tool. So I wanted to bring us back to the book a little bit in the sense of some of the sort of big ticket items. So they start off the book, as we've been discussing, with sort of, you know, these are the things that they sort of have found to be errors in thinking. So the fallacies of learning, and we've touched on some of them, but you know, just to sort of be more explicit about it, you know, one of the things they talk about is this masked practice concept, masked practice concept. And so, what's the problem with masked practice? Can anyone define it for us and sort of explicate the problem with it? I think, Frank, you sort of touched on it earlier, with sort of the cramming example.
Took the words right out of my mouth. To me, it's cramming, and it's, you know, it's that thing that so many students have done, because it works on the short term. You know, so just wait and don't worry about studying until the night before, and then just cram it in your brain, regurgitate it on the test, and then as soon as the test is over, you've forgotten it. I think one of the things that just has made me roll my eyes is, as we plan out school calendars and school officials would say, now we have got to make sure that we end that first semester and that we have given our exams before the winter holiday rather than, you know, come back and do those exams in mid-January, because the students will have forgotten everything by mid-January. I just want to say, well, if they've forgotten it then, what's the point? Yeah. don't we sort of want them
to be better for them in the long
later life?
You learn it again if they refresh their memories after the vacation.
Yeah.
And we've seen from this book, there's documented studies and research showing that is the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not just not just reviewing your notes or rereading something or cramming for exams, as I'm sure we did sometimes in college, but also over time.
No, me never. Never.
Retrieving information.
Yeah.
I know I did that for a few French exams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I always knew. Go ahead, Frank.
You know, I think one of the best examples of the way to do it right, my ninth grade English teacher who said, you know, well, here's our spelling words. And, the standard spelling test, okay, these are our words for this week. And then, all right, we take the test, and now these are our words for the next week. So you learn the new ones, you can forget the old ones. Well, hers were, all right, this week, here's 20 words. And we're going to, you know, a test on 20 words. And then you're going to have some more words for next week. And half the test will be on the new words, and the other half will be on the words we've had earlier this year. So as the year went on, half the test was the new words for the week. The other half of the test was any of the words that you had up until that point. So really what we had to do was continue to review and refresh and keep practicing with those words all the way through the year. And I still remember some of the little mnemonic devices that she would tell us as far as how we could possibly remember how to spell a particular word. Anonymous, with his tail cut off, and there's no E on the end. Those kind of things that, you know, 40 years later, I still remember, because it wasn't learn it, take the test, forget it. It was learn it and that word may come back on any weekly test from here on till June.
That connect your good teacher to another of the important learning principles, which was mix up the practice.
Yes.
So space it out. Don't do everything all in one clump. And also switch up what you're learning with different things. He had some sports examples for this. Say you're on a team, you're having hockey practice or soccer practice or football practice. Instead of drilling only on one thing for half an hour and then switching to a different thing, make the sections much shorter so that you're switching up the skills.
Yeah.
Called interleaved practice.
Mm-hmm. A few curveballs, a few fastballs. Yeah. And I think conventional wisdom is, all right, let's learn multiplication. So let's do 50 multiplication problems. All right, we got multiplication now. Now let's do division. Let's do a whole bunch of division problems. And really what you need to do is mix them up so that you're really thinking about the concept and not just going through the motion.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
Adult learning too was people who are learning to identify bird either just by the different birds or maybe by looking at old Audubon paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of looking at 50 examples of one bird and then switching to the next bird and looking at 50 examples of that one, you want to look at just a very few, maybe was it, say, 5 examples of one, and then start switching it in with other birds so that your brain learns quickly, starts thinking, how do I discriminate between them?
So yeah,
that was very interesting, too, part of the interleaved practice, varied practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and there are a number of applications that sort of help you do that, and so I was actually thinking about this recently because I've been recommending to a friend of mine started medical school maybe a year and a half ago or something like that, and he hadn't known about the concept of spaced repetition, right? That the one of the things that it talks about in the book, this idea of going and repeating these things on a schedule so that you're reminded of that particular material as you get further away from the initial understanding of the material or initial exposure to the material. And so there are a couple of programs out there. One is sort of notable called Anki, A-N-K-I, and I'll put a link to the software and the website in the show notes. And so Anki is a spaced repetition tool, and I think the most popular sort of use of that is Pimsleur's language learning courses. They're all done using the spaced repetition concept. And so I recommended it to him, and immediately, his grades got skyrocketed. He did so much better in school because, you have so much to memorize. In medical school, Anki was helping him to be able to do that. And what the only missing element, I think, of Anki is the idea that many times people tell you, oh, well, don't try and learn multiple languages at the same time or anything like that. And what I've decided to do is to actually, merge my Anki cards for French and German and Spanish and Italian and so on and so forth, because I think that the differentiation of those, pieces will help me latch on. Like, I have a fairly strong German vocabulary, but maybe my Italian vocabulary is not so great. So being able to relate the German vocabulary to Italian will actually say, oh, right, this word in German has sort of this, maybe is a cognate, or it has a very similar, Latin base, and that will help me remember more. So I'm sort of curious about maybe testing that out and seeing how it all works, or maybe doing, a couple of sessions of Duolingo in one language and then doing a couple of sessions in another. And so that sort of interleaves
Have you used the Anki flashcards yourself for that?
I have. Not for mixing, not yet for mixing, but I'm thinking about actually taking the decks and merging them is my point, because I'm curious about whether or not that would actually be fruitful for me, because I feel like I'm always going very deep into one language. Recently I've been doing a lot of French study, and so I've spent months and months and months focusing on French language, and I feel like I'm doing that to the detriment of the other languages that I know or want to learn. So
not only I think detriment, but there's a whole chapter in this book about that very thing, how important it is. Mixing up your practice.
Right, exactly. So that's sort
probably
of my ongoing.
You can take away from the book that really will help you.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. Yeah. So that's sort of where I'm thinking about it in terms of, and I'm curious whether or not there's any anyone who sort of has pushback about this, because I'm thinking that it actually might be very fruitful for me to be able to mix up the languages, even though traditionally people think that if you try to learn multiple languages at once, you're going to be sort of conflate the languages and make more errors. But I think that's a good thing. I think it's that tough part of separating the two, but making the connections, the neural pathways that tell you these are connected, and therefore you're going to resurrect it from your brain, better along the way, first retain and then, be able to recollect
German
it.
Speaking German and you sort of just toss in a French word, it's European.
Yeah, exactly.
German vocabulary right then. Just say the French
and
the German accent.
There we go. I'm sure that most French and Germans wouldn't probably mind, the errant French or German.
It'd be impressive if the Americans were speaking that language anyway.
I'm sure they would. Yeah. So moving along in the book. So the authors sort of toss out all of these various sort of misnomers and some other suggested practices as we've been talking about. And one of them that they also talk about is the idea of sort of multiple intelligences. This was first posited by Dr. Howard Gardner, and initially he was rather ridiculed for this idea that humans have multiple intelligences, and then of course onto the topic of different learning styles. And I'm curious about folks' sort of thoughts on what the authors were basically saying about addressing the learning style issues. And I think I talked a little bit about this at the top of the call, but I think it's worth sort of discussing a bit, because it's so important for us to really be aware of the science of the fact that, they've really just debunked the fact that there's nothing that supports, the idea of us having learning styles that matter as it relates to actually learning. So that while you may have a preference to hearing something, other people, that doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't learn in all the ways in which you could be taught. And actually, the more ways you're taught something, but the appropriateness of the way you're taught something is actually more important, right? And they give pretty good examples of that. But I wanted to hear people's thoughts about that and what what you sort of have taken away from the book regarding learning styles.
I could talk about this just for an hour. This is fascinating.
And it's
not as much of a pet peeve for me as you mentioned it was for me, for you people, using as an excuse the different learning styles. But I heard that just last month, someone on a board I'm on said, well, I'm not good at such and such. I don't like that, and that's not the way I learn. People have different learning styles. And I didn't get into an argument about it, but I said, well, sometimes it's good to learn things using more than one style. Maybe you'll learn it better that way. And now I'm reading this book saying there's actually no proof saying that people learn things better when they learn it in the style that they feel more comfortable in. It's more important to use the style of teaching that is appropriate for the material. That's very interesting.
Learning
like you said, it's debunking what is a widely held thought out there, I think.
Right. Well, I guess about 20 years ago, learning styles was a real big concept in education. And, you really wanted to, use an instrument to identify every child's learning style and then teach to that child in a way that matches that learning style. And that's really now gone by the wayside. And the conventional wisdom is the more senses that you can use as you teach, the better off you are. That all of us, all of the senses need to be engaged. And, don't sit and lecture to kids for an hour. That's not going to work. Get up, intersperse, have some movement, change topics, have kids do something, have them answer questions, have them interact with each other. Don't just sit there and take notes for an hour.
So you're telling me, Frank, that me tasting the glue paste during arts and crafts was actually a very good thing for me.
I don't know that I go so far as to actually taste the glue paste, although that does happen many times in those elementary, younger elementary grades. But, you know, to be able to touch something, to hear, to see, to experience it a number of ways just, you know, hammers things home.
It reminded me of, I'm a good, traditional learner. I enjoy sitting there and, you know, having someone teach me things, and I take a lot of notes because it keeps my mind focused and my mind doesn't wander, and then I like to be able to refer back to them later, even a few years later now, just, you know, searching on the computer for something I remember I learned about. But once in a while the teacher will say, "Now put down your pens. Don't take notes right away. I just want you to learn this. Just listen." And I didn't like that. I'm like, you know, let me learn however I want. I want to, you know, listen and take note. But now if someone says that to me, I'll think of this book. I'm like, well, all right, I'll put it down and I'll try to, you know, hear it this other way.
Yeah, one of the things that I was thinking of throughout the...
mentioned this earlier, right? Oh, go ahead, Frank.
No. Go ahead, Bonnie.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, like, how do we learn things on our own, say, if we're taking classes now or at conference, when there's a lot of information flowing in. I haven't yet figured out how this book, Making It Stick, would apply to something like learning at conferences when, you know, you have 45 minutes on one thing and maybe 45 minutes on another thing. And I'm not going to stop taking notes. Sometimes I try and draw more in my notes, you know, force myself to get out of just typing words and do like sketch noting or something like that. But maybe the answer would be the reflection. Sometimes pause, or maybe at the end of the day, think back, you know, what did I learn today, and try and make some connection.
Yeah. You know, and I've often been to, you know, at conferences where the presenter says, now, you know, I'm going to give you my PowerPoint deck, or I'm going to give you a bulleted list. So there's no need to take notes. Just sit back and listen. But personally, I find that the act of taking notes and me having to make decisions about what I write down and what I don't write down and how I organize it, to me, that's helping me learn it so much better than getting a copy of the slide deck afterwards.
Well, that's sure how it feels to me. I feel like I'm listening better and learning more when I take notes. And thinking,
yes,
what will my subtitle be? How does this relate to the section before?
Yeah.
Should these be numbered or bullet? But what if that's a misperception on my part? What if that's one of the illusions of knowing? It feels good, but what if it's not good? How will I know?
Well, I think also that when you're taking those notes, if you're not taking the notes and you're simply listening, I think it's human nature, and we see it all the time at conferences. I mean, as you look around at the other audience members, what are they doing so often? Email, and, you know, it, all kind of off-task behavior. So they're not even really listening. They are doing something else. So the act of taking notes, at the very least, it keeps you engaged with what it is you're supposed to be engaged with, rather than off-task behavior.
I think there's reasons I take so many notes. Keeps me listening. Keeps me with the speaker.
Yeah, I think there's two sort of prongs here that we're sort of talking about. One side is sort of focus, right? Your attention. How much of your attention is actually given to the speaker and to the content itself? And then the other side is actually learning. And, you know, of course, some aspect of learning is you focusing on that material, but it's actually then the encoding, right, is basically taking that material and adding it to your own current knowledge base. And so I think that writing down the material, taking notes, is a help to focus, but it's not necessarily a help to your ability to have a long-term comprehension and retention of that material, because what it does is it basically says, I've got a crutch. I've externalized this information, and so therefore the maybe like something similar maybe to the Zeigarnik effect happens, right? It will stay on our shoulder and sort of keep reminding us that we know it, but because we've externalized it, we no longer need to know it because it's somewhere else. And so our brains sort of turn off and give up on it. So I think there's some benefit to actually taking notes as long as you go back and actually review those notes when you leave, say, said workshop or conference or whatever, and then review it again, you know, a couple weeks later, then a couple of months later, and so on and so forth, each time asking yourself, what do I know before you look at the notes, right? So it's that kind of little self-test that you say, like, what do I know about this material? What do I remember, and how can it apply to my life? and then I think that overcomes the taking notes part, because I'm a sparse note taker. I do take notes, but it's usually very, very sparse. It's like, you know, again, I'm a big questioner, so I was probably that, you know, kid in school who asked too many questions. And I can actually remember a high school conflict that I had with my high school chemistry teacher, she did not like me asking questions. I could just tell you that much. And it ended up having my mother come in because my, you know, because we just couldn't resolve. Yeah, we couldn't resolve the conflict, my mother clearly, you know, made it clear to the teacher my son was going to ask whatever questions he wanted, and we were going to be okay with it. So I appreciate my mother for her dogged protection of me and my questions, because that's just how I learn. I have to ask those questions, and so I'll sit down in a conference, and I will frequently, again, like, even though I could. And, you know, it depends on the presenter, you know. So if you can interrupt the presenter and ask a question, then I would most likely just raise my hand and ask the question. But if I can't, I'll usually write those questions down for the question and answer session. But I'm always writing them down, and then, like, key terms, right? So I'm just, like, capturing key terms. And, you know, sometimes I use the Cornell note-taking method. Sometimes I don't. And the experience is that I am attempting to sort of remember as much as I can, and then be able to recall that for later purposes, but just enough to trigger the memories, you know? So, I don't know. I don't know if that really helps solve the problem for anybody, but I think that's sort of the approach that I take, which is that, you know, I think note-taking is for, you know, sort of retaining attention, but remember that the notes themselves have to help you sort of resurrect that information on a regular basis, again, spaced repetition, so that you can then recall it later and actually utilize it. Because I think the vast majority, and I'd be curious about your thoughts on this, but the vast majority of the information that you take in at a conference is never looked at again after you leave and is, like, basically lost. And I try not to do that. If I'm going to go to a conference, I'm going to spend 3 days of my life at a workshop or conference, I want to utilize that information.
I'm going to add something here that's just from the book, from research. How learning occurs: encoding, consolidation, retrieval, and then over time, if you want it to lead to extended learning, building mental models, relating what you're learning to your own life or to what you already know, and then updating the retrieval cues,
mm-hmm.
throwing
mm-hmm.
that in there as some key term.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And one of the other things that I thought of was, I don't know if anybody has experience with the Montessori schools or the Montessori concept. I know there's another one that I watched a TED Talk from the owner of some large company. He was talking about a school system that he had developed as well or funded or something like that. But the idea was for students to actually work on project-based materials, and then they would learn the appropriate, you know, say, algebra and geometry and, you know, social studies material and English writing skills in order to sort of bring the project to fruition. And so since the curriculum was based on the project, it's much more natural learning. The kids are hands-on learning this material and sort of interleaving the learning process of these different, you know, areas of academic, you know, study, so that they can sort of make this project happen. And I'm curious if others have experienced it, have kids in the program or nephews in a program like that, and what your thoughts are about sort of teaching our kids in this fashion, as opposed to having a curriculum that is, let's just teach, you know, a vertical of language skills and writing skills, and then, you know, social studies skills, mathematical skills, and so on and so forth.
I really don't care. Research shows, and I'm not in education, but just thinking of my own schooling, which I think was pretty good. When younger, there were more sections, but once you got older, like to middle school and junior high, the things started connecting to each other more, and the projects got larger, and say, well, this month we're going to learn how to do reports, how to do a book report, and then how to do a different report, and then do a report on one of the other subjects that you learned. So I was not in a Waldorf or Montessori school, but I definitely, as I got older, saw that they were taking the different pieces, the different subjects we had started with, and then connecting them and, like, growing them into wider subjects.
Yeah, I don't have experience with the Montessori schools, but project-based learning, that's one of the new waves in public education. Now, you know, it now has its own acronym. It's PBL, and everybody understands what PBL is. And in There's a school very, very close to me, a very rural school that had not been a very high-performing school at all, high dropout rate, that sort of thing, that instituted the project-based learning where everything really centers around. It's more like the workplace, and it's collaboration, and we're working together. And, Ray, like you say, we're learning the math that we need in order to get this particular project pushed forward. The dropout rate has just decreased to almost zero. The big question on the table is, how do those kids perform against other kids when they say move to another school that is more traditional, or they take the ACT test, or they go into college and have to perform more in the traditional manner. Another thing in talking to the teachers, it's awfully difficult to, because you're basically having to devise the curriculum and not only devise your own, say, particular subject, which would be tough enough in itself, but as a group of teachers devise a curriculum. That's a tough one, when it's 10:30 at night, and what are we going to do tomorrow? What am I going to kind of pull out of my hat to do tomorrow? And, of course, the more years that goes on, though, and you can use what you had from the previous year, build on it, stuff gets a little easier as you go along. But it does seem to have a lot of promise, both in terms of student engagement, that they enjoy school more, that it is relevant, and they seem to retain the material that they learn a lot longer because they're actually using it.
Yeah, it sounds to me like it requires a bit of like fundamental redesign of the entire K through 12 as well as post-secondary school education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much that instead of seeing individual desks, you see tables, half a dozen tables around the room. The kids are gathered around tables working in groups, and oftentimes walls being knocked down that, two, three, four classrooms are just combined into one larger space. And, of course, that brings with it its own set of challenges in how to pull all of that off.
Right. And a lot of this comes down to what I, again, another one of my soapboxes. I clearly have a lot of soapboxes, everybody. But, is the idea that, we take children and we put them in a very structured environment that doesn't actually teach self-management skills, and we expect them to then leave secondary school, and whether or not they get post-secondary school education, they go into the workforce and lack the productivity skills, the self-management skills. I use the terms interchangeably, personal productivity, self-management. They lack those self-management skills, and then, they lose self-efficacy, they lose personal autonomy because of various factors within the workforce. And I think that this book, gives educators as well as managers and employers a really great sort of framework for being able to address some of these systemic problems and make a more cohesive system. So I hope the policy, the policy people that are around in the world are looking at this and hopefully infusing it into curriculum, into all the curricula, and as well as into the training, professional development training and that kind of thing that's happening out there in the workforce. Because I think the two need to be sort of integrated. There's no reason why we need to, teach children in a different fashion than they're going to have to perform when they leave school. I don't necessarily mean that we don't structure in a way that's safe and helps graduate them from one level to another. But the idea that the framework is so dramatically different, I can just speak from my own experience, and maybe you all have had similar different ones. But, I went through school, and those skills I learned in school weren't necessarily a large part of what I learned in school were not the things I needed when I went into the workforce, many of those skills I learned independent of my schooling. And I went through a pretty good school system in New York City, and I was given, all of the advanced, I was in, all the various advanced programs, and, I was given French from basically first grade. I was in French class and all the way through secondary school. So, I was given all of those sort of additional steps up. You know, I went to a middle school for the gifted and talented. I went to a very good high school where I was engaged and challenged, and was also the PBL concept. You know, was starting to come into being in this very progressive environment. And so I was given a lot of this opportunity, but I still feel like when I stepped out into the real world, I was like, okay, well, I learned all of that stuff, and I'm telling you, I haven't used a stitch of geometry that I learned in school in the real world, and
haven't diagrammed a sentence in a long time either. Huh?
Yeah, exactly, and I think that's not true. I probably have used geometry. It just is in much more light touch, and like that's when I'm like, okay, YouTube, tell me about this geometry thing, and. as opposed to trying to, recall it and teach it from memory. Actually, something that came up in my mind a couple of days ago was, you think, God forbid, the world were to have some big natural disaster, and you had this, small group of people, who had to, basically repopulate the world and teach everyone, what we knew before. How many groups of people could really do that, And you look at, the Late Show or the Daily Show or these kinds of shows that are on television, and they interview people on the street. And they ask, who's the president of the United States, and they can't name the president of the United States. Better yet, do a geometry, formula to save their life. That's a problem. It's a real problem that we don't have this material sort of combined and connected in and as we are being educated. So anyway, off my soapbox again.
What is the best balance for people? Something I noted down from the book is that there's crystallized intelligence that's a little bit more like facts and knowledge and procedures and mental models that we've learned and built up over time, and then fluid intelligence, the ability to see reason, relationships, think about abstract concepts. And maybe this is talking about liberal arts versus vocational education. Maybe a lot of the things that we learned in high school or college, maybe we don't use those exact facts anymore, but they may have taught us how to think about things and how to learn about things. Maybe geometry helped you learn how to reason or see spatial things or how to logically think about problems. And so that's one thought. And another is, I guess I forgot the other thought.
It'll come back to you.
The last few years, there's been a lot of talk. When I was in New York City, there's a lot about talk about coding and disruptive education, and everyone needs to learn to code. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but maybe people don't even need to go to college anymore. They just need to learn to code. And on the one hand, I'm great with vocational education and coding, but on the other hand, do we want to take away all liberal arts? And just if everyone only learns how to code, then what about art and philosophy? And you need to have things around you to code about.
Yeah, that wouldn't work. So we're nearing the top of the call. So I wanted to hear anyone's final thoughts about Make It Stick as we close out the conversation. Anyone's final thoughts in terms of things we didn't touch on in the book that you wanted to touch on, and any other final thoughts, and then whether or not you'd recommend the book. Whether or not you recommend the book, any final thoughts?
I have three final thoughts. I'll go first and then let Frank.
Okay.
Jeff and Ray, of course. But one is, these are just some things I noted down that to remember. One is, failure underlies the scientific method. Qualities of persistence and resiliency, where failure is seen as useful information, underlie successful innovation. Just something to remember when we are facing difficulties with learning things or make mistakes or are trying to remember something and can't, that that's part of failure, and that in a wider sense, yes, failure underlies the scientific method because you have hypotheses and theories and test them, and then you find out something doesn't work or isn't the same as you thought, like, for example, the eight learning styles or the types of intelligence. And that, brings us closer to knowledge and the things that we have around us. I don't mean good scientific technology things.
Yeah.
There is mastery is a quest, especially of complex ideas, skills, and process. So my brother told me recently, and he's more sort of a, not rigid, but he's much more structured than I am and good at making schedules. And, you know, when he says he's going to stop doing this one thing and start another thing, he's better at doing it than I am. But he got up on the praise team at church where they sing, like four people get up in front of church and lead the congregation in song, like with microphones.
Uh-huh.
Not dancing, but, you know, really engaging with the congregation. And that is just not like him at all. And I was like, wow, you know, don't tell me people can't change. But he told me that it was sort of hard for him, and he thought a lot about it, and he watched himself in the mirror to make sure he wasn't going to, you know, make a fool of himself. But I was like, it's a good example of if we want to learn new things or, you know, improve things we're not good at or change. This book gave me an optimistic feel, you know, keep on working at things. You can improve them.
Yeah, it's about being in that, and taking yourself outside of the comfort zone is actually what creates the learning, you know, opportunity. Keeping in the comfort zone doesn't make you learn. How about you, Frank?
Well, I think my overall thought, and going back to the very first of this call, I couldn't believe I didn't know about the book. It's one I think really ought to be required reading for those in education. The points that are brought out in the book, the space practice, you know, that sort of thing, it all lines up with, now at 56 years of age, looking back on my education and what did stick, so quote unquote, with me, and what was successful. It all is here. The things that worked are the things in here that they advocate. One in particular over in the chapter that talked about increasing your abilities, and they talked about mnemonic devices. They got into a little concept called places that the ancient Romans and Greeks used in order to memorize long speeches and that sort of thing. And that was the very thing that got me through some of the more challenging courses where I had to really internalize a large body of notes that you would see in the margin of those notes, little pictures that I had drawn, because what's happening was I was really mentally walking through buildings that I was familiar with, and the things I was trying to remember from those notes, well, those became people that I was mentally placing in the rooms or posters I was mentally placing on those walls. So to try and remember those notes was really just taking a mental walk through that building that I was very familiar with. And that worked in every graduate course I ever had, and was so pleased to see it here. I had first seen it in a little book called The Memory Book, written by Jerry Lucas, the Hall of Fame NBA player. And we just delighted to see it talked about someplace else, because it is something that works so well for me. But I really think this ought to be required reading of everybody going into education.
Yeah, it's funny you talked about the method of loci, or the journey method, as it's
yeah,
sometimes known as. And I forget what book it was that I read some time ago. It had talked about the method, and I was sort of thinking about things, and I actually created a mnemonic for remembering the concept, which is AILS, AILS, which is for association, imagery, location, and story. And so therefore, you know, you sort of take each of those, you know, how do you associate material to what you already know, and then creating images for them, placing them in places, and then creating story for it. So if anyone is interested in learning about the journey method, that's a good mnemonic to just sort of keep it top of mind. And I'm in the same place, Frank. I mean, I've used AILS or the journey method or the method of loci in so many contexts, from, you know, presentations I've had to give to, teaching people. I've used it as actually an entire teaching method, and I think going back to that concept, I think both in childhood education as well as in adult education, you could actually utilize that method for teaching, you know, so that you can help people through giving a story and placing the content of what you're teaching along that story path, along that story plot. So I think there's a lot of applicability to mnemonics and to the journey method for those things. And as you can imagine, since I recommended the book for the book club, I definitely do recommend the book and think it's a fantastic book for everybody to read. So if you haven't yet picked it up and you're listening to the podcast, feel free to go ahead and pick it up and give it a read. It's a great read. Any final thoughts from anyone on the line? Otherwise, I just have a couple things to close us out for this conversation of Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning by Peter C. Brown et al. Going once, going twice. All right, great. So thank you all for this really great conversation. The hour went by so quickly. And so a few announcements before we end the call. First and foremost, if you're a podcast listener, the callers you just heard in this episode are readers just like you, and you are more than welcome to join us on the live calls to discuss productivity books too. You can visit productivitybookgroup.org, productivitybookgroup.org, and find out the details in the schedule for upcoming book discussion calls. And if you plan to read a little plan to read ahead, you know, skip a couple months and read a book in the future or read a little bit more slowly, please visit productivitybookgroup.org and check out the schedule on the upcoming books page. We only have a couple pages on the website, so it's pretty easy to find. Just click on upcoming books. Please feel free to visit iTunes or whichever podcast directory you use to access Productivity Book Group and review us there. Some folks don't know this, but Google just launched their podcast portal, so now you can actually listen to Productivity Book Group on Google Play Music. Just search for Productivity Book Group, and you'll find it among the podcasts. So go ahead and do that, and you can also subscribe there. And what I learned is you can actually download those episodes. You can, like, auto-download them, so they're available for you locally, so you can step off of your Wi-Fi or cell network and be on the subway and still listen. So anyway, go ahead and review us on all of those networks, please. It helps expand our readership and brings new readers and callers to the fold. So thank you for doing that. Also, our next reading selection is going to be Switch, How to Change Things When Change is Hard. So again, Switch, How to Change Things When Change is Hard by Chip and Dan Heath on May 28th. Okay, that's at noon Eastern time, just as this call is. As the book description states, they open it up with, why is it so hard to make lasting changes in our companies, in our communities, and in our lives? The primary obstacle is a conflict that's built into our brains, says Chip and Dan Heath, authors of the critically acclaimed bestseller, Made to Stick, end quote. And so the Heath brothers take aim at helping us solve this problem with change, and I think this will be an illuminating book discussion, so I'm really excited to have you all on the call for next month. Finally, all podcast episodes are archived at productivitybookgroup.org as well. That's under episodes. So if you missed a call and want to review it, feel free to head over there. And finally, thank you everyone for joining me here on the live call. You make Productivity Book Group awesome, so stay awesome, and here's to your productive life.